Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The FT.
Welcome back to Banking Weekly with me, Patrick Jenkins. This week we'll be talking about how insurance companies are maybe providing banks with a new source of liquidity.
It's all about defined benefit pension schemes, getting those the volatility and the risk of those kind of exposures off of ordinary corporate balance sheets into the hands of insurers, banks, reinsurers, other people who are supposedly better prepared and able to handle those sorts of risks.
Then we'll take a look at the latest news from the Basel Committee, the international regulators for banks, and what they're saying about CoCos and hybrid debt.
Basel has not yet pronounced on contingent convertible itself because it has very strict definitions of what counts, but it is looking at hybrid capital.
But we start today with a look at JP Morgan's results, which came out on Friday, and what they mean for the upcoming results from other US banks later this week. Joining me to discuss this and all this week's topics is Charlene Goff, our banking correspondent, Brooke Masters, our chief regulatory correspondent, and Paul J. Davis, who joins us for the first time this week. He's our insurance correspondent. So we'll start off with JP Morgan. Charlene, you've been looking at the numbers that came out on Friday. They looked pretty impressive, and the boss of JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, was sounding pretty upbeat, really.
Yeah, he was. The profits were up almost 50% to about $18 billion. So a real recovery there for JP Morgan following obviously a very difficult year last year. And this was really driven by a big recovery in the retail side of the business, losses on mortgages coming down quite sharply, losses on credit cards also coming down. And this was coupled with sort of slower revenues from the investment bank. And that seems to be a trend that we're going to see throughout the industry this week.
One of the things that boosted their numbers was a big release of provisioned reserves for losses, which I'm guessing is something we're likely to see from some of the other banks later this week, particularly Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, exactly. We should see that coming through. And that also in the US is coming with a sort of more broad recovery. You know, like you said, Mr. Dimon was quite upbeat about consumer spending. That seems to be coming back a bit. You know, he was saying that this is the start of sort of a broader US recovery, which should push up shares and get people feeling a lot more confident. Obviously, the likes of Goldman will be offset by weaker revenues from the investment bank, and that will hit trading revenues there, and that should also hit the bonus pools, which is the big issue this week.
As at Morgan Stanley, I suppose. But it'll be interesting to see how they compare overall. The shares in JP Morgan, I think, bounced quite sharply, didn't they? Up by about 3% on Friday. So,
And likewise, their peers in the industry also were boosted by JP Morgan's results and the expectation that they would be up a bit this week.
What about the carry across for European banks, which start reporting the following week? Is there stuff to say there? I guess it's the banks that look most like JP Morgan that are going to follow this similar trend.
I think it's going to be a real mixed bag this time. I mean, in the UK, you've obviously got banks, RBS and Lloyds, with their own big problems. So, you know, they're still going to take a while for any sort of recovery to come through. Barclays will be a bit of a mixed picture. I mean, there's some concern over the kind of slowdown that might have been seen in Barcap. Likewise, across Europe. So I think it's too early to say, right, we're really far into the recovery and, you know, things are really gathering momentum now. But things generally, the signals are that this is going to be a bit better, a lot more positive than it was last year when we saw real washout results from the banks.
One final thing on JP Morgan, interesting on what they chose to pay their bankers. They paid a so-called compensation ratio, which includes basic pay and bonuses, of about 37%, which is way down on the kind of historic levels of between 40 and 50% for Wall Street. But it's actually higher than it was a year ago. Brooke, do you think that heralds what Wall Street across the board is likely to do and what we're going to see generally?
I think so, because remember, last year was a phenomenally profitable year for a number of the investment banks. So they could deflate the percent they set aside for revenue without actually hurting their people. I think also, as we're starting to see, even in the U.S., there is some pressure to control bonuses. Sheila Bair last week who runs the FDIC, said that they were looking to force deferrals of bonuses. And the U.S. has really been the holdout on trying to control banker pay in some way.
From a regulatory point of view, it does look like the U.S. is going to come into line with the rest of the world, at least to some extent.
I think to some extent, probably not quite as harsh as the EU rules that have kicked in this year, but certainly the U.S. is less of an outlier than it was.
Well, we're going to see. Sorry, Charlene, you wanted to say something on that.
No, I mean, just with these bonus figures, I mean, you can sort of spin them either way because you've got the lower averages per person, and particularly with Goldman, they've been hiring very aggressively recently, and you know, per person they're likely to be down. But like you say, the overall sort of proportion of revenues being paid out, a lot of banks have to boost those up. Their senior bankers can actually get, you know, the pot of money that they want to stay.
Absolutely.
It's going to be quite an interesting bonus round where you can see the sort of different trends emerging there that banks are having to
reconcile. Really. Yeah. And we're going to see that, I'm sure, played out particularly sensitively in the next week or so. I think probably later this week we're going to have news in the UK from the so-called Project Merlin, which is debating how banks should pay their people and also the lending commitments they should make. So we'll be watching out for that. If I could turn to Paul now on this topic of how insurers can play a role to help banks with their liquidity needs.
The news here, I suppose, the interesting thing that happened last week is Goldman Sachs, their pensions buyout arm, which is called Rothesay Life, finally won this deal to buy out Paternoster, which was one of the original alternative specialist startup pension insurers from sort of just before the crisis. Not a huge deal in itself. It's interesting. It doubles the size of Goldman's pensions business to about 7 billion sterling worth of business done.
UK specific business. It's just
It's all about defined benefit pension schemes, getting the volatility and the risk of those kind of exposures off of ordinary corporate balance sheets into the hands of insurers, banks, reinsurers, other people who are supposedly better prepared and able to handle those sorts of risks. And Goldman definitely wants to continue to expand that sort of business in the UK and elsewhere as well, as it becomes more viable as something to do, especially for Goldman's clients. But it also gives Goldman a good pool of pretty liquid fixed income assets, sovereign bonds, high-grade corporate debt, as well as some, you know, more crappy corporate debt, which is what got Paternoster into trouble in the first place, which they can then lend either to themselves through swap deals to their own sort of the Goldman Sachs balance sheet, or on to other kind of commercial banks who are more in need of funding. And this is something that we've already seen a lot of investment banks trying to sell as an idea to insurers and pension funds, sort of increasing talk about it in the last few months of last year.
Basically, the investment banks are go-betweens between the insurance company liquidity that's basically there and available, and banks that are crying out for liquid funds
to provide. I mean, all of this comes about because the financial crisis put a monetary value on liquidity, in essence. Liquidity, liquid assets being things that people are happy to trade, happy to hold, where the markets are functioning, and you know that you can always get rid of them if you need to some cash. It's going to become even more important to find new sources for these assets as the special liquidity support scheme at the Bank of England and ECB schemes are wound down. And the Bank of England, in its financial stability report, called these kind of repo trades with insurers as a good sort of private sector replacement for that sort of thing.
There's also an issue with the Basel Committee having said that starting in 2015, there will be requirements for banks to hold a certain amount of liquid assets to make sure they can get through a market crisis that lasts 30 days or so.
But it's not just that the market's not working properly, it's actually that the standards are going to get higher. So for two reasons, there's kind of going to be extra demand for this kind of stuff.
And obviously, if they can find a way that will let the banks have the liquid assets in case of crisis, but does protect the pension schemes at the other end, so that if all else fails and the bank goes bust, then the pension scheme or insurer is not left without some sort of assets to back their business.
I guess that is an important point that listeners might be interested in. Yeah. You know, what happens with these assets?
These swaps are always collateralized, and one of the interesting things about all of this is the fact that for the insurer, the only extra risk you supposedly bear is the counterparty risk, i.e. the risk that the bank fails. Now, it's a AA credit or something like this or higher. It's a fairly sort of low risk. However, the asset that you might be taking in exchange for the government bonds or high-grade corporates that you're swapping out is not going to be as good as that, mostly. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that you don't actually have to recognise the risk of that asset because it's not really yours, it's just there in case the bank fails. Whereas the bank gets to recognise the more liquid, higher quality assets reduce its risk-weighted assets and therefore its capital. Yeah. And one of the interesting things about this whole subject is if it becomes an enduring, a habit-forming trend, if it replaces the liquidity schemes and doesn't just become a transition but becomes something that's set up for a long time, then those sorts of arrangements lead to a kind of an artificial lowering of capital between the two legs of the trade and therefore in the system, which is exactly the kind of risk and capital shell games that got us into this mess in the first place.
Well, we'll have to keep a close eye on that. We'll be relying on you, Paul, to make sure that this doesn't spiral out of control. While we're on technical points of capital management, Brooke, you've been also taking a look at the latest that the Basel Committee, the international regulator, has to say about another element of the balance sheet game, so-called contingent convertible bonds, and how they might work in the new bank capital makeup.
Basel has not yet pronounced on contingent convertible itself because it has very strict definitions of what counts, and that it's not going to do for a while. But it is looking at hybrid capital, which of course was used by many banks, particularly in the UK, but also elsewhere, to bolster their stock of Tier 1 capital. And the problem with this stuff in the financial crisis was that it was absolutely not loss absorbing. The taxpayer took the hit long before the bondholders even had to have their shares suspended. As various people point out to me, in some cases in continental Europe, it actually was loss absorbing. So there's an interesting question, like what went wrong in the UK? So what Basel has said is starting in 2013, if you're going to have some sort of hybrid capital, which is generally something like a preference share or some sort of debt that converts in a time of urgency, it actually has to have a formal trigger written into its documentation saying that if the financial regulator, say the FSA here or whatever the FSA is going to be the PRA, says this bank is going bust, it's non-viable unless we trigger this, then they can convert it over and it's supposed to save the bank.
Just to use the dreadful adjective, it needs to be bail-inable.
The problem with the pronouncement is that it's very short on detail and no one is 100% sure what they mean by the regulatory trigger. There isn't a hard trigger like, you know, if your capital falls below 5%, this goes boom. And so there is some nervousness about whether they're going to be able to sell this stuff.
Paul, did you want to add something on that?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about all of these new instruments is who is actually going to buy them. And insurers and pension funds especially, obviously, were very, very big investors in hybrid bank debt, more junior bank debt, helping to fund the expansion of their balance sheets going into the crisis. Mm. Now, this kind of convertible stuff is incredibly difficult for most areas of insurance and pension asset management funds or units to buy, because while they have very strict rules and they can hold certain types of debt of certain grades in certain proportions, but maybe cannot hold equities at all.
It seems likely with the kind of blurring of the line between equity and debt that we're probably going to have new funds set up specifically to buy this stuff. I know the hedge funds, for example, are kind of looking at the idea of setting up specific cocoa funds or bail-inable debt funds. So be very interesting to see how this all changes the markets. It's bound to change, I think. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. We'll be watching over the coming week the US results very closely. And this time next week, we'll be looking ahead to the Davos agenda. This is the World Economic Forum that convenes from next Tuesday. We'll also have the return of Stateside, our look at the US banking agenda. It's all next week. For this week, all that's left is for me to thank Charlene, Brooke and Paul. And to thank you for listening. Banking Weekly was produced by LJ Filotrani. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.